This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I'm joined this afternoon by Dr. Sixin Resonant from the University of Helsinki. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So, I'm sitting on the other side of the table and I'm feeling a little bit out of my depth at the moment because I am a time domain astronomer and you have come to us from the world of cosmology beyond the Standard Model. So I'm going to have to be on my toes for this. From what I gathered during your special seminar that you gave this afternoon, you have been looking into new possibilities with using the Higgs boson to explain inflation. Is that correct?
That's right, yes.
So starting off from the beginning, I suppose, could you explain to our listeners what is the Higgs boson and where does it fit into cosmology?
Yeah. So the Higgs, of course, became a superstar when it was detected at the European Particle Physics Laboratory, CERN's Large Hadron Collider, and a Nobel Prize was given for it in the past few years. And Higgs is best well known for the property of giving other particles their masses. And the way this works is that the particles in the Standard Model, with the exception of the neutrinos, the origin of neutrino masses are not known, so let's set them aside. But for the other particles, they're basically massless. But they behave as if they had mass. And the way this works is that the Higgs field fills all of space, and these particles interact with the Higgs field, which sort of impedes their motion. So it looks as if they had mass. This is like, if you consider, like, for example, if you walk in water, it's more difficult for you to walk. It's as if your feet were heavier because you're going through a medium. So likewise, the elementary particles are going through the medium of the Higgs field. And the more strongly they interact with the Higgs field, the more it impedes their motion. So the heavier they seem to be. So that's the particle physics picture of the Higgs. And then it was realized in 2007 by Fedor Bezrukhov, who is now at the University of Manchester, and Mikhail Shaposhnikov at EPFL in Lausanne, that one can use the Higgs field, which is filling all of space, to also explain things about the early universe, so about what happened in the first fraction in a small fraction of the first second. And this ties into something that's called cosmic inflation, which is one of the most important research topics in cosmology. And cosmic inflation is currently our best explanation for where the seeds of structure come from. So if we look at the universe, so starting from the Earth, I mean, of course, we see really, really complicated structures. You know, we say DNA, we see humans, trees, and then we have planets going out, stars, we have galaxies. These galaxies form filaments and walls and voids. So the question is, how have they formed? Where have they come from? And our current understanding is that everything has grown from very small fluctuations of the order 1 in 100,000. So if we look at the early universe, say when the universe was, 100,000 years old, then the matter was very uniform. So there were no planets, no galaxies, no structures, and there were just these small variations, one part in 100,000 in density. And then because of gravitational attraction, the parts that are overdense accrete matter, and they form the nuclei of galaxies where planets form and we form and so on. So everything that we see, all of the structure, you know, humans, all human culture, is traced to these random fluctuations. And inflation was invented in the 1980s, if you want to use that term, as a way to explain where these original small perturbations came from. The idea is rather simple. You have some field that's filling all of space, which in the case of Higgs inflation is the Higgs field. And this field, its gravity is repulsive instead of attractive. I won't get into why. And therefore, it pushes different parts of space-time or different parts of space away from each other. So the expansion accelerates. And so all these inhomogeneities that may have been there before are swept away. So the universe starts to look almost the same in all places and all directions. And then there are just small quantum fluctuations on this field, which generate these sort of small ripples. When inflation ends, then this field decays, produces the particles that we see now. And in places where the field value is bigger, you generate more particles. Where the field value is smaller, you generate less. And this gives you the inhomogeneities. Now, Inflation was invented as in the 1980s, but it wasn't until 2007 that it was realized that you can use the Higgs field that you already know to exist to drive inflation. And this is really, it's a very conservative, a very economical way of doing cosmology, in the sense that you really try to say, let's start with what we know to exist and try to go as far as we can with it. So can we do inflation with just the Higgs field? And it looks like we can.
Okay, so it's pretty fundamental to how we came into being.
If it's true, I mean, there are hundreds of inflationary models. I would say Higgs inflation is the simplest. It doesn't mean it's the correct model. So we have to wait for a few bit more observations and see whether these observations fall into line with the predictions of Higgs inflation or whether they go against them and show that this is not the right model.
Okay. So a nice phrase that you mentioned back there was using what we already know about and pushing that as far as we can to explain what we observe. Because an alternative that you mentioned at the start of your talk is perhaps using supersymmetry. And so this is more getting onto the nature of dark matter and what that might be. So is it worth giving a little recap at this point as to what supersymmetry is?
So Higgs was the last pillar of what is called the standard model of particle physics that was discovered in 2012. And this simple yet grandiose name of the standard model was all of the pieces were put together in the 1970s. Higgs field was invented in the 1960s independently. And they said, okay, we can put it together as part of the standard model. Then all these bits were found one by one. Higgs field was the last one in 2012. And it was already in the 1970s when standard models put together, people realized that, okay, this is probably not the final theory. I mean, we know this is not the final theory. Let's think about what is beyond that. And it was generally thought that there would be new physics right around the corner, so that if you find the Higgs particle, and then you will also find a whole zoo of other particles as well, that sort of fix what we are seeing as, I would say, aesthetic problems, aesthetic shortcomings of the standard model. And supersymmetry, I'm not sure if I want to get into details, was one such proposal for going beyond the standard model that was very popular at the time, that in the when applied to these problems of the standard model, basically predicts that for all of the particles we know, there is a supersymmetric particle that has the same kind of properties. And if supersymmetry were exactly true in nature, these new particles would have been seen. So there is, okay, supersymmetry is not an exact property of the real world, but it's somehow currently the universe, it's broken, it's violated, which is, and in particle physics, there are often these sorts of symmetries that the fundamental theory possesses, but in our current state of the universe, they're broken so that you don't see these theories, so that you don't see these symmetries. For example, in this case, symmetry between the ordinary particles and the supersymmetric partners. Ordinary, they have almost the same properties, but the supersymmetry is broken so that these super partners are heavier. Therefore, we haven't seen them. You know, if you think of colliders, you collide particles together, and then you produce new particles. But you cannot produce particles that have masses that are heavier than the energy you put in the collision. So if your particles are very heavy, you will not see them in colliders. But in order for this, and the idea was that these new supersymmetric particles have about the same, you know, this difference in the masses of the same order as the Higgs mass. So when you find the Higgs, you should also find these new particles. And this was widely shared expectation. And none of these new particles have been seen. And this is a disappointment, disillusionment, one might almost say, for many people in the physics community. And this has sort of led to a bit of change in philosophy, certainly change that I have embraced, that instead of looking for these complicated constructions beyond the standard model, we would want to stop and see, let's look at the structure of the standard model just a bit more carefully and let's see what we can do with it. And supersymmetry is one example of these extensions, but there are others.
Mm. Because I remember when I was a fresh-faced undergrad, starting back in 2012 at the University of Sussex. So this would have been a few months after the discovery of the Higgs was announced. And of course, we had particle physicists in the department working on supersymmetry. And as I progressed through my studies, I became more aware of this and more aware of them becoming slowly more demoralized as it became apparent that supersymmetry was not going to be one of the favored ways forward.
Yeah, but really that was just, in physics, it's rare for things to happen in such that you have one big observation and that completely changes things. I mean, sometimes it does happen, but more it's an accumulation of knowledge. And okay, supersymmetry has not been seen at the LHC. It was also not seen at Tevatron, which is a big collider, was a big collider at Fermilab in Chicago. It was not seen at the collider LEP2, which is in the same tunnel where the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is now. And people, always expected, the next collider with the next upstate, finally we will see something. And, it's like, you're wandering in the woods and somebody's telling you, no, this is not the right way. And you say, no. If we continue, a few kilometers more, then we see the mountain we're heading to. And you don't see that. No, a few kilometers more. And there's no rule of science. There's no scientific method that will tell you at which point you should stop and change direction.
So this would be a good time to steer this back to what you've been doing, as in using the things we already know about. We know about the existence of the Higgs. So you have been exploring the possibility of the Higgs generating dark matter candidates in the form of black hole dark matter. That was a phrase that immediately jumped out at me from your slides. And somehow I had not heard of this before today. And so I think for the benefit of the listeners, we need to fix that. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we know from astrophysical and cosmological observations that about 80% of matter is dark. And dark doesn't mean that it's hiding something behind it. It just means that we don't see it. We don't see it with light. We see its gravitational pull. So we see how it affects the motions of visible matter that we do see, how it affects the motion of light. But it doesn't emit light, it doesn't absorb light. In a word, it's invisible. Invisible matter might be a better name than dark matter. And there are hundreds of particle physics candidates for dark matter, meaning you introduce some new particle with certain properties. And actually, dark matter is in a sense, very easy to do. Like, if something is invisible, like we don't see it and we also can't touch it, it sounds very exotic, from the everyday point of view. But from the point of view of physics, it's very simple. We see things because the stuff that we are built from, so that is to say atoms, have electric charges. So I see you because light from the lamps is hitting the electrons, the outer electrons in the molecules of your skin. And it's then coming from them to my eyes and hitting the electrons in my eyes. Now, if I didn't have any electric charge, the light coming from you would just go through me. Or if you didn't have an electric charge, the light would just go through you and I wouldn't see you. And likewise, I couldn't touch you. So all you need is a particle that doesn't have electric charge and that is stable so it doesn't decay, and there you can have your dark matter. But what is, I think, less appreciated, that in principle, you don't even need a new particle. I mean, so dark matter could consist of black holes. So black holes, of course, you wouldn't see them. And if you have the right amount, so if you have about, 4 or 5 times as much as you have ordinary matter, then they would be the perfect candidate. The question is how to get these black holes. We, of course, know that there are black holes in the universe. So we know that there is a black hole that has about 4 million solar masses at the center of the Milky Way, center of our galaxy, and also centers of other galaxies. So we have these gigantic black holes. Then we know that we have black holes of, say, of the order 10 solar masses or so, which, of course, were spectacularly seen by the LIGO gravitational wave detector, which got a Nobel Prize for this discovery. And we think that these about 10 solar mass black holes are formed in collapses of stars and then stars and black holes melting together. If we want dark matter to be black holes, the solar collapse is not an efficient enough route. For one thing, we know that there was dark matter before there were any planets or any stars. So it needs to come from very early times. And basically, what you need to generate black holes is just you need to have a big enough overdensity of matter that will then, accrete matter, collapse. If you just put enough matter just densely enough, it will generate a black hole. And I earlier mentioned this cosmic inflation. So in cosmic inflation, you have these quantum fluctuations from which are the seeds of galaxies. So these fluctuations are so small, of the order 1 in 100,000, that you don't generate black holes. Instead, you have this more gentle process of accretion and structure formation. But it may be possible during inflation to generate, in addition to these small perturbations that act as the seeds of more structure, to generate very large perturbations that then seed the black holes that would act as dark matter. So in a sense, dark matter can come from the Higgs field. The way this works is a Higgs field has large perturbations. At the end of inflation, Higgs field decays to ordinary matter, and then this ordinary matter would collapse to form black holes.
Okay. So in this scenario, how massive would these black holes be?
Yeah. So first of all, we have quite tight observational constraints on black holes as dark matter. Namely, because if black holes are dark matter, there are a lot of them. I mean, there's 4 or 5 times as much as we have of ordinary matter. And they can affect observations in various ways. For example, if they're the right mass, then they can. There are a lot of them in the Milky Way, around the Milky Way. So then when they pass between the line of sight of us and the star, you can have gravitational lensing, so you can see the star twinkle. And this can give you constraints on them. And there are many other observational methods that I won't go into for determining black hole masses. So from the observational point of view, these black holes probably have to be very, very light, in the sense they cannot be these gigantic black holes at the center of galaxies, they cannot be these 10th solar mass black holes, but they have to be very, very small. Also, if you look at the mechanism that we put together using the Higgs field for producing black holes, it turns out that if you want to produce both the black holes and the seeds of structure, so you have to have these two kinds of inhomogeneities, this is very constraining. And this puts a constraint that basically the black holes, when they first form, the mass has to be cannot be bigger than about 1 ton. And then, of course, one of the big contributions of Stephen Hawking to physics was the fact that black holes radiate. And 1 ton, like on an everyday scale, seems like a lot. But on astrophysical scale, it's quite light.
Yeah.
And the smaller black holes are, the more they radiate. So if you start with these 1 ton black holes, they would evaporate. So Hawking evaporation means that a black hole emits radiation, so it loses energy, so therefore the black hole loses mass and shrinks, becomes less massive. And it may be that Hawking evaporation is such that the black hole evaporates completely, there's nothing left, then they cannot be the dark matter. However, if the Hawking evaporation stops at some point so that you have this relic, this sort of inert nugget left over, which is a possibility, then in that case they could serve as dark matter, and in that case they would evaporate from 1 ton, down to what's called the Planck mass, which in the unit that we're used to is about 1 microgram. So in this case, dark matter would consist of 1 microgram black holes with quite a small number density. So typically have in the volume of the Earth, it would have about 1 million of these small black holes.
Oh, okay. So yeah, it's a good point that you make there, because obviously they have to be able to survive through to the present day.
That's right.
And Hawking radiation was something you touched on in that lecture.
That's right.
So for these black holes on the order of micrograms, yes, this isn't something that we would be able to detect with, say, LIGO?
No. First of all, even if these black holes were to collide, the frequency, so the wavelength of gravitational waves that they emit, would be far too small to be seen with the current gravitational wave detectors, or indeed any foreseeable gravitational wave detectors. That's one thing. Another thing is that there are so few of them that collisions are probably very, very rare, also because they're extremely small. So, and you know, if you have 1 million of them in the volume of the Earth, and you know, the weight is 1 microgram, so think that you have these tiny, tiny motes of dust, you know, they're not going to find each other and collide. So there won't be gravitational waves that you can detect from them. And in fact, if dark matter does consist of these black hole relics, then it's probably we will never see them, except through their gravity, which of course is why dark matter was introduced in the first place. So this means that, you know, this model, this idea, you know, can survive a lot of observations, which is of course very bad for a model.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Are there any further observations we can make?
So of this idea, of these black hole relics as dark matter in general, if that is microgram relics, no, except of course if we detect, if dark matter is something else and we detect that something else, then we say, okay, there is no need for this or there is no room for this. For this specific model that we propose, where they, where these black holes are generated from the Higgs field during inflation, then this particular model makes specific predictions about the ordinary fluctuations that are the seeds of structure. So currently they agree with observations, but as observations become tighter, maybe they agree, continue to agree, maybe they don't agree. And in particular, this model also predicts that at these normal seeds of normal structure are generated, then also at that time gravitational waves are generated. So these are not gravitational waves from black hole collisions. These are gravitational waves from fluctuations of vacuum. They really generate literally from nothing during inflation, the quantum fluctuations of the vacuum. And this model predicts that they have a certain amplitude, and they may be, and these may be detected in the near future.
Ah, okay. Okay, so it does make solid predictions that can be tested in the future. That's good. Well, I do have one other area, well, not specifically of astrophysics, but pertaining to physics and astronomy in general, that I'd like to touch on.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have come to JBCA at a perfect time. As it so happens, last week when myself and Josh and Emma were filming the March main episode of the Jodcast, I was talking about publishing in astronomy and astrophysics because I follow the blog of Professor Peter Coles in the dark, and I saw your guest post there about the future of publishing and the direction that it might, or that it will hopefully will take moving to open source. So when I saw your name circulated on the email this morning, I immediately thought, right, I have to sit down with this person. So, you've been published recently in the Open Journal of Astrophysics. How did you come to hear about that? Be my first question. Because I only heard about it through following Peter's blog, and I'm in the field.
Yeah, it was probably actually from the blog of Peter Coles. But I've been following this open access issue, and more specifically, overlay journal. We'll get, I think, in a moment to what that means. Overlay journal issue in cosmology and astrophysics for a while. So in 2006, for example, there was a project called Rioja, which was set to develop these sorts of websites and this sort of software architecture for low-cost peer review in cosmology, because peer review is really the issue that we should concentrate on, rather than open access. But maybe we have to go a bit back to explain this.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, let's take a step back to that phrase, open access. Because obviously you mentioned in that guest post the archive, which is something that I certainly use every day, and I'm sure, well, at least I hope all of my peers use it as well if they're keeping up to date in the field.
Yeah.
So you mentioned there that the problem of open access, people being able to read things that have been published and accepted, has already been solved.
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk, and now also actually also a lot of money and a lot of movement around open access. Of course, in particular, we had Plan S last year, which is this European Open Access Initiative. Earlier, there was a Scope 3 initiative, sort of steered by CERN and others. And the starting point of all of these open access initiatives is very simple. It's the fact that journals cost too much. When I say too, you ask too much in comparison to what? They cost so much that libraries cannot afford them anymore. Now, a few years, the Library of Harvard University made quite an unprecedented appeal to staff of Harvard saying, please resign from journals that are not open access because we cannot afford to subscribe to these journals anymore. You know that's quite spectacular. So everybody knows that this is the problem. Journals cost too much. And unfortunately, what has been done in open access is not to go back to the roots, but try to, so not to address the cause, but to address the symptoms. So typically open access, the basic idea of open access is that instead of subscribing to a journal, you pay the journal to make the articles freely accessible. But the question should not be, you know, And then the question can be, you know, is it the author of the journal who pays, the institution who pays, whatever? But we should be not asking the question, are we paying the journal for subscriptions or for access? We should be asking, why are we paying these journals? What are we paying them for? And scientific publishing is really quite a spectacular field. So if we take cosmology, for example, what happens is that first, researchers do the research for free from the point of view of the journal. They are, of course, paid by their institutions, so mostly from public funds. But let's talk about from the point of view of the publisher. They do the research for free. They write it up for free. They publish it on the archive, net archive. They give it to the journal for free. Their peers commit do peer review on the for the journal on the article for free. Editors decide whether to publish and coordinate peer review. Sometimes editors get paid, sometimes they do not. Then, if the article gets published, then the institution of the researcher pays the journal so that the scientists who produced the article can read it. I mean, sometimes scientists even pay the journal that they can publish there. And as a result, the scientific publishing industry, you know, it's worth $25 billion a year.
That's a lot of money.
You know, that is a substantial amount of money. And if you look at journals, journals of that sum are maybe 7 to 9 million euros when you're talking something that's so approximate. It doesn't really matter whether it's euros or pounds. So billion, sorry, 7 to 9 billion. Just to put this into context, this is likely more than the total salaries of every postdoc employed in every field in Europe and the United States combined. So these are huge amounts of money that are going to the publishers. And the question is, what are we getting for it? Because journals, of course, used to be very important. First of all, you would register, you know, who has done what in the journal, you know, so you can get the merits, because that's very important, you know. Scientists don't really work for the money. They work for the glory, like for the prestige.
Yes.
You know, I have this result.
Yes.
This is me.
The acclaim of having done the next big thing.
Yeah. So this is pretty, okay, this person did that. Then, of course, they also distributed the research, and they also acted as archives. Namely, you have the journal, then it's in the library, you can the library shelf, so it'll be archived and accessible, by the way, for free forever after, you know, after they bought the journals. You don't need to pay again in the old days. And then they did peer review, so that's, which means just basically you have some quality control. But now, in cosmology, when you put things on archive, so this open internet archive, it's registered there, you know, when it was submitted, it's distributed, and it's permanently archived. So the only thing that journals are needed for is peer review, which scientists contribute to for free. So I don't know if there is any other field of business where the industry, where the corporation gets the raw materials for free, the work is for free, the processing costs, so the labor force, you know, it doesn't get paid, the processing costs are negligible, and what's also important is that the customers buy everything that they produce, you know, because libraries have to buy these journals. So, and this is reflected in the fact that if you look at the scientific publishers, the most notorious one of which is Elsevier, of course. So if you look at their margins of profit, they are bigger than for Apple, Microsoft, or Google. You know, the profits are, you know, more than 30% every year, the margins of profit, sometimes as, you know, large as 39%. Okay, this is, of course, good for the business, but it's very bad for science because we don't need these journals anymore. So Plan S and others are really, for example, they're committed to working with the industry, working with the journals, and they say we have to reform the publishing industry, you know, to bring down these costs. I think this is completely false. We do not need to reform the publishing industry. We need to abolish it. When we're talking about journal publishing, I mean books and so on, that's a bit different story. And one way of doing it, one very simple way of doing it, is overlay journals. Because if you know that the work is anyway published in these open internet archives, and that's the way it's been done in cosmology, particle physics, many other fields of physics, mathematics at the moment, and there is no reason why this cannot be extended to all fields of physics, you only need to do peer review. So an overlay journal is something that only does peer review. This Open Journal of Astrophysics is one example. So what it does is you put your paper on the open archive. Then you go to the overlay journal's website, say, this is my paper published on the archive, I want to peer review it, I want to publish it in your journal. Then your peers review the paper as normal, and if it's accepted, then on the website of the journal, there is a note, you know, this paper was published on this website and there is a link. When you click on it, it goes back to the archive, and you also note on the archive, this journal, this paper was published in this and this journal. And if you look at the costs, so the estimated costs of publishing a single article in, with commercial publishers is from 3,000 to 5,000 euros per article. If you look at the actual costs of what running an overlay journal is, it's you can say that it's probably, for example, Open Journal of Astrophysics, the costs are well less 100 euros per article.
It's a big saving.
So we are talking about a factor of 30, factor of 50, you can go below that, maybe a factor of 100. And if you look at this open access, let's say, so if you look at Plan S, if everything went according to plan, and the publishers would decide to play ball with open access and, you know, lower their cost and blah, blah, this would result in savings with a, of a factor of between 2 and 5, according to estimates, which would still mean that we would waste literally billions of euros every year paying publishers for nothing.
For services that we can effectively provide for ourselves.
No, that we, no, that we are already providing ourselves.
Mm.
So it's just the, that they do the... they what they provide is the prestigious quality stamp. You know, there is this good quality journal, so you should publish there. And also like this, so I published an Open Journal of Astrophysics, and it was a single author paper. Other papers that I do with my PhD students, I rather publish in traditional journals because it's because I don't want their career to be hampered by the fact that, you know, somebody looks and says, oh, they where did they publish? You know, I don't know what this journal is. It's, you know, probably some maybe it's some predatory rubbish journal or something. I want people to see, you know, this they published in the best journals. And that's why we need to, the community needs to step up and establish these journals. An Open Journal of Astrophysics, I mean, they have a very good editorial board. It's a very serious journal. And taking a few years, it will be it will be considered respectable. And then my PhD students can publish there. So scientists need to step up and just start founding these overlay journals, you know, getting people of who have high status in the community together, putting them up. You know, the software is available off the shelf. You don't need to write anything yourself. The main problem, as I see at the moment, is that scientists are not paying the costs of journal publishing from their own pocket. Okay, scientists would say that this is not a problem, like this is a merit. You know, it's a good thing.
I mean, it's the taxpayers' money, so yeah. It's still very much a problem.
Yeah, yeah, so it's a problem, but it's like this, but you know, it's this tragedy of the commons. Nobody's paying off of their own pocket, you know, it's offloaded onto from some common budget, so it's not your problem, it's the community's problem. But I think we as a community really have to take this seriously, because as you said, it's the taxpayers' money. You know, every article that they publish, think about it, you're wasting thousands of euros of taxpayer money.
That could be gainfully spent elsewhere.
Yes. Yeah. So imagine, you know, if we really switch to overlay journals and we could, you know, double the number of postdocs. You know, if you think that instead of publishing, let's say you publish, depending on the field, let's say you publish 4 articles a year. So let's say that you would get, you know, extra, you know, 20,000 a year. You know, let's say your group, you know, for every article you publish, you would get, you know, few thousand euros a year extra. And if you think of this at the level of the institute, you know, we are talking about significant resources.
Mm. Yeah. So I have to admit, I myself was not fully aware of the scale of this issue until this brought it to my attention. And so I then dived into it and went through it with Josh and Emma on what will be a previous episode now. So, well, as a PhD student, I can speak from the other side of this. I've submitted my first paper to one of these big name journals.
Mm.
Because yeah. I need that quality stamp.
Absolutely.
To be able to get up the ladder.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the take-home message from this then, it's the big-name academics, those who have the power to vote with their feet and who can safely do so without harming their careers, should throw their weight behind this.
Yeah, absolutely. Because even though I say we have to abolish, or maybe it would more kindly abandon, you know, the corporate publishing model, we also have to do it in a way that doesn't destroy young researchers' careers. You know, so to say, oh, everybody co-publish in this, you know, I think everything would eventually be in these overlay journals. But to say, oh, you know, immediately everybody go publish in these overlay journals, it's not fair. It's especially not fair to young researchers.
Mm. I have one last question with
mm-hmm.
hopefully a little bit of nuance behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are publishers out there who aren't necessarily private corporations like
yes.
Elsevier.
Yeah.
Because, well, in this odd end, the specific example I cited was MUNRAS.
Yeah.
So that's the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society.
Right.
So that publishing arm is by a university. It's Oxford University Press.
Yes.
So it's the journal of a specific society rather than a private entity. Do you feel that they would survive under this new model?
Mm.
And if so, what would they look like in the future?
Yeah, so this is an important point. So let me first of all say that the fact that not all respected publishers are corporate publishers doesn't really change the overall picture. Because even if we would only switch away from corporate publishers and, you know, keep the scientific societies the same, the overall amount of savings would be about the same because the corporate, because most of the publishing is corporate publishing. But if we look at the societies, so of course, again, we have a problem, we have a problem of transition, of being in a transition era, is that traditionally these societies, so these journals have served two functions for these societies. First of all, of course, they have helped to spread scientific knowledge and, you know, advanced science.
Yes.
And that has really, and I think we can say that is really, that has been, and I think that should be their main task. And second, of course, they have generated revenue for these societies, which is, of course, needed. I mean, the societies don't run on nothing. At an earlier stage, when, you know, journals were published on paper, when, you know, you couldn't distribute things almost for free on the internet, these two goals supported each other. But now in this transition era, the situation is, if I may use this term, somewhat perverse, in the sense that now scientific societies are sustaining their operations by charging large fees for these journals, thus impeding, in fact, the advance of science.
By putting up those barriers to
access. Yes. So I would say that we have to develop a new funding model for these societies, to the extent that the societies are dependent on the journals, that both generates revenue for these societies and advances, or at least does not hinder science. And I think this is a real challenge.
So in this case, there are competing interests that need to be balanced here, because obviously the societies themselves do important work. It'd be a terrible shame if they were lost.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't know about you, but I don't have an immediate answer to that question off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think this is something that really needs to be addressed society by society. You see, so what kind of different kinds of ways they have of generating revenue, how big a part is the journal publishing and so on. So I don't think there are any one-size-fits-all answers there.
Yeah. So we're in agreement that change does need to come, and it won't happen overnight, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's true, but on the other hand, it's not going to happen unless people actively work for it. Because, you know, this open, already in the 1990s, you know, librarians complained that those rising subscription prices are a doomsday machine, because as it has become cheaper to produce these journals, the prices have gone up and the situation has become more difficult. So in this, as in many other things, there is nothing, things don't change by themselves. And often when say, oh, it's difficult, it doesn't happen overnight, this is used as an excuse for inaction and thinking that the problem would solve itself. Unfortunately, we have seen now from experience that this is not true.
So it will keep getting worse unless we get up and actually do something about it.
Yes.
So I feel I may have taken up a little too much of your time this afternoon, so maybe we should bring things to an end here.
Thanks for having me.
So, well, thank you very much for your time.